The Baseball Tonight podcast is presented by LinkedIn Jobs.
Way out of here. Oh,
goodness. This is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Wednesday, May 26, 2021. Buster Olney is off. My name is Jesse Rogers, writer for ESPN.com. Excited to be with you today. We have a good show for you. Mark Feinsand from MLB.com is going to join us. Senior Vice President and General Manager of the White Sox, Rick Hahn, will join me as well. And Joe West, the legendary umpire who broke the record for most games umpired last night at Guaranteed Rate Field when he umpired behind the plate for the White Sox and Cardinals. Time for news and notes around the league. Let's start in New York, both sides of town. Jacob deGrom returns from injury, gives up just one run over five innings, no walks and nine Ks. So it looks like the old deGrom out there, his ERA just 0.80 as the Mets win. They need their walking wounded back, and they get one of the best in Jacob deGrom. Now to the other side of town, Corey Kluber coming off his no-hitter, leaves the game after just three innings after having tightness in his right shoulder. He's going to be further evaluated today, and he could face another MRI. This is a guy that had 2 years of injuries, comes back, throws that no-hitter, and now just a few days later has to leave the game. So a huge blow for the Yankees, who have one of the best pitching staffs in all of baseball. So we'll find out more on Kluber soon. Philly slugger Bryce Harper put on the 10-day IL with a bruised left forearm. He's in an 0-for-16 slump. Joe Girardi wasn't that forthcoming with the news over the last few days in explaining why he was or wasn't in the lineup, but he finally had to come clean as Harper is on the IL, which, you know, he joins a lot of players around the league, including the Indians' Zach Plesac, who, get this, broke his right thumb ripping off his shirt after coming out of the game on Sunday. Rather aggressively ripping off his shirt is how Terry Francona put it. He was not happy with his start, so one of those freak injuries that's really going to hurt the Cleveland Indians, who are in second place in the AL Central behind the Chicago White Sox. How about the Dodgers back in Houston? The whole scandal reignites itself, the cheating scandal. Of course, it'll be a bigger deal when the Astros play in L.A. later in the season, but that's now a rivalry between those two teams. The Dodgers took the game 9-2. And finally, the Rays saw their 11-game winning streak come to an end when Brad Keller pitched seven strong innings against them as the Royals beat Tampa Bay 2-1. But Tampa atop the AL East. Man, what a bunched and really good division that is. That race is going to be great as the summer heats up. Now time for the good stuff. Leading off, Jacob deGrom, back from injury, helps the Mets beat the Rockies.
Strike three call. Got him with a fastball in the outside corner. Make it eight. Struck him out. Three in a row for DeGrom, nine for the night.
The Blue Jays, in a big AL East matchup, beat the Yankees behind Vlad Guerrero's 16th home run.
He drills the ball right center field, and it is gone. He has done it again. And he is all alone atop the Major League home run leaderboard right now. Number 16 for Vladdy. And it's 2-0 Blue Jays.
The Braves got back to the 500 mark finally as Ronald Acuna Jr. helped them to beat the Red Sox 3-1.
And the pitch. Swing and a hard hit ball down the left field line. That'll go all the way to the wall. Sandoval rounds third. He's going to score. Contreras heads to third base. He will stop there. And Acuna's at second base with an RBI double, and it's 3-1 Atlanta.
The Chicago Cubs drew within a half game of first place thanks to Jock Peterson, who hit two home runs in a win over the Pirates.
1-2 the count to Peterson. Ponce steals, and this one is golfed to deep right center field. Look up. It's gone. Home run number two on the night for Peterson. Brand new ball game, 3-3, Cubs and Pirates here in the fifth.
And the Indians kept pace with the White Sox in the AL Central thanks to Jordan Luplow and his two-run homer as they beat the Tigers.
The pitch, a swing and a high fly ball headed to deep left center. On the run is Badu, and it's gone! And just like that, Luplo makes an adjustment and blasts a two-run home run to left center, and the Indians lead it 4-0.
Before we get to MLB.com's Mark Feinsand, White Sox GM Rick Hahn, and umpire Joe West, now streaming on ESPN+, The Ultimate Fighter, the reality show that brings top MMA prospects together under one roof to compete for a UFC contract. It's back. Watch the season premiere on Tuesday, June 1st, only on ESPN+. Sign up now at ESPNplus.com. Also, keep up with all the NBA postseason action by listening to the Hoop Collective, the Woj Pod, the Low Post, and Jalen and Jacoby, wherever you get your podcasts.
For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Mark Feinsand covers MLB for MLB.com, and he joins me on the Baseball Tonight podcast. Mark, let's jump right in. You're a guy that keeps an eye on that trade deadline. We're 2 months out, so let's zoom out from 30,000 feet and take a look at this. It really seems like there's been some separation, even from the beginning of this month to the end here. No longer are we talking about Seattle or Kansas City. So it does feel like there are certain sellers, and already we know who maybe the buyers will be. To me, it feels like it'll be a seller's market. Do I have that right?
You know, I'm not sure. I mean, I think the one interesting thing about this year versus last year is that without the expanded playoffs, you may not have as many teams believing that they're serious contenders. But that said, there still are two wildcard spots. And I think that until a team sort of looks at itself in July and says either A, we're not good enough to get to one of those wildcard spots, or B, even if we get them, we're not good enough to really do anything. Then you'll see it. But teams really tend to take a longer approach to this. And, you know, very few teams rush into making deals. That said, you can look at some teams and say they should rush into making deals, right? I mean, the Rockies aren't going anywhere. Trevor Story is going to be a free agent. He is going to be one of the top players traded at this deadline. There's almost no question about it. There's no reason for the Rockies to hold on to him at this point. You know, to me, a really interesting team is the Twins. Came into this season off of back-to-back division championships with a lot of expectations. And here we are sitting almost on Memorial Day, and they're 10 games under 500, 9.5 out of the division, 9 games out of a wild card. And it's like, they have some pieces that can help some other teams. I wrote about this the other day. They're taking a measured approach, but I think they are realistic about where they stand, that if they don't turn things around, you know, in the next 10 days, then they're going to have to start looking at potentially being sellers.
It really seems like the buyers are going to be where you are in the East. The AL East is bunched up. The NL East is bunched up. Different ways of getting there. The NL East doesn't look very good at times. The AL East looks like it has some powerhouses. But to separate, I feel like whoever can do the damage at the trade deadline might be the winners in both those divisions.
Yeah, that could certainly be the case. I mean, you know, Brian Cashman and the Yankees have never been shy about making a move in the middle of the season if there's one that they think will help them. Chaim Bloom, very smart guy as well. Eric Neander, obviously, with Tampa Bay. You know, you wouldn't think of Tampa Bay as being a team that could take on a big contract. But I think in the right situation, they can get creative and make something work. So, you know, I think there are certainly holes for each team that need to be addressed sometime between now and July 30th. And like you said, the question is who's going to do it, who's going to step up. And if you can find a couple of teams that are looking for the same thing, that's when a seller, that's when it really becomes a seller's market, because, you know, if you can get a couple of division rivals bidding for the same player, you can jack up the price a little bit. Obviously, that ends up being pitching more than anything else. Almost every team needs pitching, whether it's rotation, bullpen, or both. Position players don't tend to have the same appeal at the deadline. Think back to Manny Machado going to the Dodgers, you know, just a few years ago. The Orioles got five marginal prospects for him. When you're talking about trading an impending free agent position player, don't start looking at teams' top 10 prospect list, because you're not getting any of those guys for a 2-month rental.
It's a great observation. It really does flip. In December, you can get something for a great position player, but almost nothing for a closer. In July, you can get a ton for a closer and almost nothing for a position player. I think it's kind of obvious why those closers can affect many more games than a guy that gets, you know, four at bats. Now, four at bats is a lot of game, but look, a hitter can go into a 2-month slump. Like, if you have an elite closer, he's probably not slumping if he's already had four good months, but position players are just more volatile.
Well, and here's the other thing when you're talking about a market, right? So the Rockies are going to go out and shop Trevor Story around. Well, let's see. The Yankees have a loaded infield right now. Boston has Bogarts at shortstop. Tampa Bay has Wander Franco on the way. Right. The White Sox have Tim Anderson. You don't have very many teams that are in need of a shortstop right now. I mean, even if you think back to when the Dodgers acquired Machado, they didn't need a shortstop either. Right. They had Corey Seager and they moved Machado to third. So, you know, you have to be in the right position where a team or two are in need of that position player. Whereas, like I said, every team can get better in the bullpen. Most teams can get better in the rotation, you know, with what's out there. And, you know, that's where position player becomes tricky. You know, I thought the Brewers were a good landing spot potentially for Story. They went and traded for Willy Adames last week. I still think the A's are the ideal landing spot for Story. Elvis Andrus has been terrible there. And this is a team with aspirations to take that next step in October. So Oakland to me seems like the perfect fit for Story. And Billy Beane is a guy who has never been shy about going out and making a deadline acquisition if he thinks his team has a chance.
You mentioned some bad teams that will be sellers. And by definition, if you're a bad team, you probably don't have that many players having good seasons. So the pickings might be slim, but there are a couple of teams that are pretty good that could sell. So here's my question. Who is more popular come July, Jed Hoyer or Mike Rizzo?
That's a great question, because I think both of them will be. I would think Rizzo, because like I said, the pitching is king. And if the Nationals are on the fringe or out of the race, Max Scherzer is going to be as popular a name on this trade market as any we're going to hear. You know, it wouldn't be a situation where Washington is looking to dump salary or anything like that. They'd be looking at a guy who's going to be a free agent. They could try to get something back. Jesse, you know as well as anybody, that doesn't mean he can't go back to the Nationals as a free agent, right? We saw this happen with Aroldis Chapman. The Cubs acquired him, traded Gleyber Torres to get him, and then they won the World Series, and then about 3 weeks later, he was back on the Yankees again. So, you know, if the Nationals say to Max, look, you're 36, 37 years old, we want you back, and we want to make another run with you, but this season's a waste. Let's go make a move. We'll send you to a contender, try to get you, you can try to win another championship, and then we want to bring you back here next fall, and whatever we've gotten for you for in the trade with you will help us be better next year. So, I think it's one of those things where as long as the player and the club are both open-minded about it, it doesn't have to spell the end of their relationship. As far as the Cubs, I almost feel like, and you would know this better than me, I almost feel like internally they're hoping things go sour, because then they can make trades without, you know, being lynched by fans, right?
Right, without flack.
One team that always comes to mind when we talk about this is back in 2015, Detroit was 3 games out of a playoff spot in late July. And they traded David Price to Toronto. People said, well, what do you mean? They're so close to the playoffs. Why would you be a seller and trade David Price? And, you know, the common answer was because even if they got to the playoffs, they weren't going to do anything once they got there. They knew they weren't good enough. And they said, Price is going to be a free agent. We are not re-signing him. Let's get something for him. And I think, you know, the Cubs could be in a similar situation where if Jed sees this team in July and says, yeah, we're only a few games out of a playoff spot, but we don't have the team to go to war with the Dodgers, with the Padres, you know, potentially with the Cardinals if they were to make a move. You know, let's get what we can for Chris Bryant now or whoever it may be. The Cubs and Nationals are going to be two really fascinating clubs to watch over the next 2 months.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I'll say this about the Cubs. I have felt this way since March that Jed Hoyer is on a collision course for this very thing you're talking about, a very tough decision. When they traded Yu Darvish, it seemed like they were going in one direction. When they signed Jock Peterson, it seemed like they were going in the other direction. But I'll say this. If Craig Kimbrel, specifically him, is on this team, the Cubs, on August 1st, Jed Hoyer didn't do his job. Now, it's one thing if you keep Bryant. Like, you can do a little bit of a partial sell and still compete. It's not ideal, but it's possible to do. And Craig Kimbrel would be the name you would sell. He's not doing his job for the future of this team if Craig Kimbrel's on this team August 1st. You buying that?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I think back, obviously, I covered the Yankees for 16 years, and I remember in 2016, we referenced Chapman before, Brian Cashman went on this little mini selling binge, which is something the Yankees had never done. They traded Chapman, they traded Andrew Miller, they traded Carlos Beltran, they traded Ivan Nova. And everybody said, oh, I can't believe they're throwing him a towel. And I remember us going to the clubhouse that day after the trades were made and asking, and a couple of people were asking, like, does it feel like your front office gave up on you? And meanwhile, then they called up Gary Sanchez and they called up Aaron Judge and they called up a few other guys. And then they went on this huge run and they were actually in the wild card race till the end of the season. They didn't get there, but they were in the race. They were better after those trades. Trading Craig Kimbrel is not throwing in a towel on a season by any means. So I would agree with you on that, that you can make some trades without blowing it up. It kind of reminds me of Eric Neander told me a great quote that Stu Sternberg, the owner of the Rays, once said to him. He said, you can, don't be afraid to break a few windows. Just don't burn down the house. And that, you know, kind of thinks that's a similar concept there of you can make some trades. You can do some small pieces that are going to be better for us in the future. Doesn't mean you have to blow the whole thing up and start over.
Let's move on. If Vlad Jr. and Shohei Ohtani aren't in the finals of the Home Run Derby, then something's wrong because we need this. We need this, Mark, at Coors Field. We need these two. Let me ask you this. Season ends today. Which one of those wins the American League MVP?
You know, that's really tough. I think it would be Ohtani. I mean, neither team would be in the playoffs, so you couldn't really use that argument. But Ohtani is just doing something we haven't seen in such a long time. And we've been all waiting to see it, right? Since he came here, we're like, I want to see this guy who's going to go out there and throw 98 and you know, just blow people away on the mound and then go out and hit a home run. I mean, he's the most fascinating player in the league. There's no question about it. Vlad's incredible. And the year he's having is off the charts. And I don't think anybody could argue if he was the MVP front runner right now. But I just think when you look at what Ohtani is doing at the plate, on the mound, it's just so impressive. And it's just so much fun to watch. And who doesn't like seeing a guy start a game, throw five scoreless, and then go play right field? I mean, it's just, it's fun. You know, he's got a 958 OPS on top of it. So it's not like you're just saying that he's a novelty act. He's got a 958 OPS and a 237 ERA. Those are pretty good numbers right there. So I think right now, Ohtani would have to be my guy.
Well, I think I would vote for Vlad for one stat only, because we know he's a slugger, but he has more walks than strikeouts. It's insane. It's insane. So let alone the OPS numbers and everything else. But man, that guy is just starting his career. And I wonder if he's going to get the attention playing in Toronto that he should around the league, because he's absolutely a star already.
And he's 22. I mean, that's the exciting thing about guys like Vlad and Acuna and Tatis and Soto is they're all still in their early 20s. We have years of watching these guys flourish and become the faces of this league if they're not already. It's fantastic. We actually had a story on MLB.com today about seven players whose breakouts are to be believed. And Sarah Lang, who I know is a frequent guest on this podcast, talked about Vlad, and the number that she cited was his swing and take runs and just his plate discipline that hasn't been there before. He's not chasing the way he used to. He's really become a more disciplined hitter. And if that can continue, and those walks will outnumber those strikeouts going forward, this guy's going to be truly scary.
Let's end with a storyline I just don't think's getting enough attention, and it will as soon as a star goes down for a long period of time. I'm talking about the rising number of hit-by-pitches. It's insane. You go back to last year, it's picked up where it's left off. Basically, it's one. They're averaging about one per game. Each team averaging one every other game, but one per game between the two teams that are on the field. And I just feel like, man, every night is a chance for a star to go down. And we've seen a few go down. I don't know how the league handles this. You know, I've heard suggestions. You give two bases for hit by pitch. You penalize the defensive team a little bit more, but that's still not going to necessarily protect the health of the hitter. Is this on your radar?
Yeah. And I think, you know, here's the problem though. I can't 100% put the blame on pitchers, right? Hitters crowd the plate like we've never seen before. And we know that they've got the big, you know, big armor on their elbow, and they got the shin pad, and they're armored up because they know that they are going to get in there and they're not giving any of that plate away. And so I think pitchers certainly need to, you know, be more careful and figure out how to, curb this problem. I think Jim Palmer was talking about it the other day and said he hit 38 batters in 3,800 career innings. That's insane, right?
Insane.
One hit batter every 100 innings, you're basically hitting two or three guys a year. And now you're seeing pitchers who are hitting two or three guys a game. So, I think the fact that the velocity is so much higher on average than it's been, the fact that hitters are crowding the plate more than they ever have, and just the fact that you've got so many different guys coming in,
right,
who don't necessarily know where the ball's going, right? Every team has 13 pitchers on their staff and a couple of relievers who come in and, you know, throw 98 to 100. But don't necessarily know how to control it. And I know managers in the past have told me that their biggest problem is when a guy throws with that velocity and has no idea where it's going, because it's dangerous. And I mean, seeing Bryce Harper get hit in the face by a fastball, that nobody wants to see that. So, I think it's an issue. I don't know what they can do. I mean, you know, we've made so much about these substances on the ball this year, and pitchers are saying it's to help, you know, get control, but that can't necessarily be the case because the control seems to be worse than ever in terms of hitting guys. So there's something needs to be figured out, because, at some point somebody's going to be seriously injured, and that's going to be a problem.
Really is. I randomly watching three or four games, and in each one of them, a player got hit in the helmet or face. I mean, it's just insane the number of guys getting hit compared to, let's just say, Mark, you and I are a little bit the old days. It was maybe one every few games a guy would get hit and you wouldn't even think about it. Mark, thanks for doing this. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Jesse.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Joe West has umpired 5,376 games, the most of all time. And he joins me on the Baseball Tonight podcast. Joe, congratulations. You've had a night to sleep on it. What are your emotions knowing that no one else has ever umpired more games than you?
Oh, I couldn't express it all in one sentence. So I couldn't even tell you. But just the outpouring of respect and love that you know, I tell people all the time, baseball is like a huge family. And, you know, last night there wasn't a player that came to bat that didn't say congratulations. And, you know, everybody looks around and says, you know, everybody hates the umpire. That's not true. You know, they showed it last night that they do love us. And I appreciate everything that everybody did there. And it was just a memorable evening, from two commissioners being in my locker room before the game started to the owner of the White Sox and the director of the Cincinnati Reds being there. And the Reds weren't even here to play, but Walt Jocketty was there. And it was just unbelievable, the outpouring. And you know, I looked on the scoreboard when they gave me those nice tributes from, I had a tribute from Garth Brooks and from five different umpires. I mean, it was just awesome. So I, like I said, I can't say one sentence. So it was just an amazing night.
And you told me the other day that every day you've umpired a game, you felt like you were watching history. Something new could happen. And even if it didn't, you were part of history, because that's what baseball is in this country. It's part of our history. It's part of our fabric. Do you still feel that way through the blowouts and the cold weather games and the 4.5 hours out there? Do you still feel like every day you're seeing history?
Well, of course. Of course, and like I said the other day, some days history is a little bit bigger than other days, but that's the way it is, you know. And the coolest thing of this is being a part of something that's what you would call Americana. I mean, the guys came in last night to sing the national anthem because they're friends of mine. You know, the chicken came out of retirement last night. I mean, I couldn't have been paid a greater tribute than all my friends coming back for that. That was just wonderful. Larry Gatlin and Emmylou Harris were there. Basketball player Mark Eaton was there. Larry Ziegler, professional golfer, was there. Dave Casper was there. And I think Paul Krause is going to be here today, because he couldn't make it last night because he had to go to a funeral. I mean, these are Hall of Fame people. And you know what? Because they're baseball fans, they're all Hall of Fame people. That's really what's cool about it.
You know, seeing someone umpire that many games, it really is sort of the bridge to history of this sport, meaning you've seen the game in this up close in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and now this new century. Nobody has done that. And in some ways, the game has changed a lot. In some ways, it's still the same game, nine guys on the field. What's most different to you? Is it just the athletes and how much bigger and stronger and more in shape they are? Because I know back then, working out meant a few packs of cigarettes. Now it's a little different.
Well, you know, you can say the player's bigger and faster, but there's still only one or two that are like the Willie Mays and the Clemente's and the Tim Griffey's. You know, there's just a very few of those. Even though the athlete's bigger, stronger, and faster, there's only a select few that are going to reach that pinnacle of being the best player out there. And it's amazing. Like, no one ever thought that anybody would have four no-hitters. Well, I was the first base umpire when Nolan Ryan passed Sammy Koufax with five no-hitters. You know, and I was behind the plate when Willie McCovey hit his 500th home run. Now, that's something that has changed over the years, because the media that covers this covers every little thing. I didn't know Willie McCovey had hit 500 home runs. I saw it on the scoreboard. So, I mean, when I was behind the plate when that happened. And then I was, you know, I was at first base when Pete Rose tied the record for most consecutive games with a hit. And then I was behind the plate when he broke it. And these are just amazing accomplishments that happen over time. And I've been one of the luckiest people in the world. I told somebody the other day, I said, Lou Gehrig doesn't have anything on me. I'm the luckiest guy in the world.
Yeah, so yeah, you have said that before. How much harder is it to be an umpire today? Last night, you did not downplay in a bad way. You didn't say anything negative about instant replay. You actually talked it up. It's a helpful tool. But is it harder to umpire for other reasons? The technology helping the pitchers so much, they're able to spin the ball. What is more difficult, if it is more difficult than when you first broke in?
Well, I think because of the scrutiny on it, the umpires are feeling the pressure from it.
Yeah.
But replay and putting everything in perspective and judging every pitch that you call, I think that's good for the sport. I think it's good for the umpire. It makes him better.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if we use it as a teaching tool, it can be the greatest thing we have. They, They show replays to the hitter to show him what he's doing wrong. They show replays to the pitchers to show them what they're doing wrong. I mean, why can't they show it to the umpires? I think that's a good tool. And for the life of me, I don't like any umpire to be the cause of a lost game. So the fact that we can now correct our mistakes is a good thing. I think that's great.
Now, Joe, I hate to break this to you, but once in a while, I've heard some boos directed in your direction. Just once in a while, Joe. What do you, Tony La Russa said last night that you umpired with a flair. Did you enjoy sort of being the villain at times? Is that part of the whole entertainment aspect? How do you make all that? So, because there were some boos at times over the course of your career.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, if you get into this thing thinking you're going to make friends, you're crazy. It's a job that it's a thankless job, and I got a text message yesterday from this actor named Kevin Costner, and he said, you know, the reason you're there is because if you're not there, and the ball players are out there, it's just practice. You have to be there to make the game complete. And it was a nice compliment. He sent me a nice text, and it's just amazing, you know. Like I said, you know, you put this all in perspective and you're a piece of the game and you're an important piece of the game and you have to look at it that way.
That's a great text from one of the great actors of all time. I know you can't comment on present players and managers, but do you have a favorite former player, favorite former manager? Are you allowed to comment on that?
You know, Joe Morgan asked me one day, he said, who's the greatest player you ever saw? I said, Willie Mays. He said, wow, how'd you come up with that? He said, because I can't comment on players that are playing today. He is probably the greatest player I ever saw. But, you know, one of the nicest players there ever was Dale Murphy.
Yeah.
He would sign autographs right up to the time he walked on the field. So he was just a special breed, and what a wonderful human being he was. And I remember one time after he got traded to the Phillies, it was a beanball situation, and the Braves are going to have to throw at Dale Murphy. And just as the pitcher let the ball go, he said, look out.
Gave him a little warning. Joe, yeah. Is this going to be it for you? 5,376 games, you know, four more months of games, maybe the playoffs. Is that going to be it for you?
Oh, I don't know. We'll see how I feel at the end.
I think that's a good way to go for all of us, right, at the end of a baseball season.
I think so. I appreciate you calling me, and I appreciate the time you've been with me. And I know Rita appreciates you because she talks so highly of you. So,
anyway. Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Joe. Have a great celebration and enjoy the rest of this season after breaking this momentous record. Take care.
Okay. Thank you.
Rick Hahn is the senior vice president and general manager of the first place White Sox, who, like a lot of teams, have endured some major injuries, but so far they've kept themselves atop the AL Central. Rick, thanks for joining the Baseball Tonight podcast. Let's start with last night at your ballpark, kind of the center of the baseball universe. I happen to be there as well. Joe West breaks the record for most games umpired. I was thinking about this. We know how much managers interact with umpires. I'm not exactly sure how it goes with executives. Maybe there's a few phone calls to the league office about them, but what was your experience last night? And do you know Joe West very well?
You know what? I know Joe a little bit, and coincidentally, one of my, I'd say probably five or six interactions with him over the years occurred pregame last night, because as those of you in Chicago knew, we did have some weather in the area, and there was actually a slight chance that we were going to have to delay the start of that game. So usually when that happens, there's a meeting. Obviously, the sod father, Roger Bossard, presides over it, as is appropriate, and the team executives, manager, and the umpires are in the room. So I was able to speak with Joe yesterday and congratulate him personally, which was excellent, a unique opportunity to spend a little time with him, and got to hear him tell a few stories about his career pregame, and obviously everything went off without a hitch, which was the almost as good news as the White Sox coming away with a victory.
And to think he began umpiring games 3 years before Tony La Russa first managed the Chicago White Sox. That is bridging the decades, right? I mean, that's what I liked about it. Just the idea that he is part of this history of this sport, and he's been part of it for 40 years.
Absolutely. In fact, he was telling one of the stories he was telling yesterday was about Jerry Nairn, his father. And Jerry Nairn is one of our coaches who assists Tony, and Jerry's been doing it forever. But Joe was actually linking a story back to when Jerry's father was involved in the game. So his perspective was obviously extremely special, and it was nice to see a little insight to that yesterday and see him celebrated for a remarkable accomplishment.
Exactly. And I know a lot of fans probably have some polarizing opinions about Joe West, but think about it, Rick, you think you have a tough job. How about every time you go to work, half your audience dislikes you? That's the life of an umpire. So I
true,
think
it's also nice to never be wrong.
Right. Well, you know what his saying is when asked if you've ever missed a call, his answer is, no, I've gotten a few wrong, but I've always been there for all of them. I've never missed one.
Very well said.
He has a great personality. All right, let's talk about your team. Perhaps the most impressive thing of this early season run you guys have been on is you went a month without losing consecutive games. You know, there's been a lot of noise about your manager, but Tony La Russa must be doing something right when a team can endure an injury in the middle of that month in Luis Robert, but still continue to rebound every time they lose a game. What's your take?
You know, I think that's right. And I think it speaks not only to the job Tony has done, but also our coaches and certainly, and perhaps most importantly, that clubhouse. As you know, you alluded to, we've had some, much like a lot of other teams, we've had some pretty significant injuries with losing Eloy Jimenez and Luis Robert for an extended period of time, as well as having to put TA on the IL at one point and a handful of other injuries over the course of the first couple of months. And the way that clubhouse has rallied, that players have stepped up and filled that void as we've asked them to change their roles, for example, with Andrew Vaughn going out to left field to replace Eloy. And some of our players that were projected to be more complementary players playing a larger role on almost an everyday basis. It's been very impressive. And I think all of us with the club are certainly pleased with where we sit right now, all things considered, and think it's a tremendous testament to the strength of that clubhouse and the players in it.
You mentioned Jose Abreu, reigning AL MVP, but it was a shortened season. And I'm not sure the baseball world was paying close attention, but this guy's leadership in the clubhouse, as well as performance on the field, defensively and offensively, he is MVP caliber, no matter the numbers. And what we saw a couple of weeks ago when he got into a nasty collision and then played the next day, as Adam Eaton joked, your right fielder, if you're getting your ankle taped up and he walks by, you're going to jump up and be ready to play. This guy's leadership is through the roof.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. He certainly sets the tone for that room and, you know, emulates or role models, I should say, precisely how we want guys going about their business. And there was a few years back when he was a free agent, there was a lot of talk about, you know, Jose saying if we didn't re-sign him, he was going to sign himself back, and Jerry Reinsdorf saying there's no way he's ever going to play in another uniform. So there was a great deal of mutual admiration, which outside of White Sox Nation, people might not have quite understood. Or if you just looked at the raw numbers and age, it might not have made complete sense to everyone. But certainly all of us who've been around the club and have been around Jose for the first 7 years of his career understand precisely what you pointed out. And that's just how important he is to this club and the leadership he provides and what he means to us on a nightly basis.
How about a couple injury updates? I believe through their social media accounts, Luis Robert and Eloy Jimenez have kind of referenced good news. Robert with the hip flexor, Eloy with the torn pectoral. Anything new in terms of their rehab?
Nothing new. We're only, unfortunately, just about 3 weeks past Luis's injury. As I think one of his buddies posted on Instagram, he is now off crutches, which is where we expect him to be at this point. But as was the case when we announced the original injury with him, we're really not going to be able to provide a real substantive update till it's about 8 weeks following the injury. So we still have a little over a month to go before the healing and strengthening process hopefully comes to a close and we can move on to whatever's next. Aloy, you know, he is obviously he was injured a little earlier than Luis. His timeline was also a little longer than Luis's. So far, he also is in that recovery and strengthening stage, and we don't quite have enough information just yet to provide a substantive update on timeline. But so far, so good. You know, it's unfortunately going to be a long process for both of them, primarily just simply due to almost the biology of the situation, where you need to just let the injury heal, and in Eloy's case, let the surgical repair take. And then once they're on the other side of that process, we can hopefully start ramping them up and hopefully getting them back towards the end of the year.
Let's zoom out, Rick, and talk about these injuries around the league. I had our stats people look this up. Through yesterday, there were 419 injured list stints, 419. In 2019, through May 25th, there were only 254. So we've gone from 254 to 419, a lot of soft tissue injuries. Can you explain it at all? I know there's been a lot of chatter behind the scenes, and I really haven't heard a good answer. I heard one manager mention, Rick, too much Netflix during the pandemic, but we had a season, a full off season, and a full spring training. So I don't quite get it. Do you have any answers?
No, Jesse, I wish I had a good answer, especially to the soft tissue question, because that's affected us a lot. You know, Adam Engel, TA, Billy Hamilton, Luis, you know, those have all arguably been soft tissue injuries. And I wish we had an answer for, you know, precisely why, well, certainly the White Sox, which is where I'm selfishly interested, but throughout the game that we've seen that increase. You know, there is, some possibility that it's simply statistical noise and it's been a bad stretch and that's why things are up, because stuff happens sometimes. But boy, that just doesn't seem wholly satisfying. Right. There seemingly should be some sort of explanation for it. You know, we obviously playing in Chicago, we do early in the year go between some nasty weather and warm weather back and forth, which could conceivably have an effect on the body. We certainly, as you know, we're in the midst right now, I believe, of something like 31 games in 31 days, which obviously is more of a sprint than you tend to see, especially early in the season, which is a factor. But in the end, I wish we knew that sort of magic bullet so we could fix it and help not only our players, but avoid it throughout the game. Maybe by the end of the season, when we have a full season worth of data, and we can sort of look back at how our team compares to others, there'll be some obvious trends or outliers, so we can sort of figure out, you know, what's going on here. Because you're right, it deserves more attention, and thus far, that doesn't seem to be a great answer.
Do you think the words load management will become part of baseball's vernacular? I remember Joe Maddon saying that if it was, you know, acceptable, he would give his stars a week off every season. Just relax, take it easy mentally and physically, and you know we'll deal with playing without you, and come back, and hopefully you'll be healthy for the rest of the year. And now that might be dramatic, but we know what load management means in the NBA: a game off here and there. And I'm talking more than the usual one a week.
It's certainly possible, and I think, you know, as you allude to load management, it is something that you see to an extent. It may not be called that, but you know, we, for example, today we have a day game following a night game, and I know at least one, if not two, of our quote unquote everyday players will get the day off, so they can essentially have, you know, close to 48 hours off between yesterday's night game and tomorrow's night game. And that's sort of a means of again, through this tough stretch, much less over the course of a 6+ month season, trying to manage and keep them healthy. We certainly see it with young pitchers, you know, how you don't necessarily have innings limits per se, but the way we use certain guys, in our instance, you know, Michael Kopech or Garrett Crochet, is pretty strictly regimented as a means of not putting too much on their plate too soon. Certainly as, you know, as injuries mount and, you know, the cost of everything increases because of that, you could very well see teams getting a little more aggressive in terms of time off, so long as, again, there's, you know, credible information or credible data or studies behind it that shows that it's actually going to be beneficial. And it's not just strictly, we gave a guy, you know, 3 or 5 or whatever days off, and as a result, we expect he's going to be fine. Like, you need a little bit more behind it just to know that the science behind it makes some sense.
Sure. Last thing on injuries. This has really been something on my radar, and it's the rise of hit by pitches per game. It's up to about one per game, maybe a little bit less than that. Seems like there's more than one a game in the games that I've watched. Do you cringe every time, you know, one of these pitches, the guy has a bad grip and it gets away from him and it's coming in at 97, 98. You've had a few guys get hit. It's been scary. I just worry about this thing. I'm wondering if we're going to enter a phase where you're going to have to be punished by more than one base when you hit a guy. It might be two bases. I've heard that. What's your take on it? What's the behind the scenes chatter on this as well?
Certainly when it's intentional. Like, I'm very much with you that the penalty should be stronger when it's obviously retaliatory or intentional of some sort. There's simply, in my opinion, no excuse to throw, especially as hard as guys are throwing now, to throw a projectile at another person. Like, that's just idiotic from my standpoint. But I think a lot of what you're alluding to obviously isn't intentional. You know, you play a team that may have a high hit by pitch number for their staff, but you look also at their wild pitch numbers and their walk numbers, and, you know, they're consistently high across the board. They're certainly not doing it on purpose. It's just a matter of, for whatever reason, the pitcher's lacking command at this point in the year. Now, you certainly, hitters and pitchers want that to be avoided. No hitter is enthusiastic, or most hitters are not enthusiastic about getting hit, even though they're getting on base because of it. And you're absolutely right. Given the velocity that the balls are now coming in at, you know, you absolutely cringe when one gets away and gets a guy, especially if you're talking in the hand or wrist area where you could do, you know, some extended and serious damage to someone. So again, for me, more a function of command than intent. So I don't know if more stringent punishment is necessarily going to deter anything from the ones that get away. But perhaps, again, as they continue to examine, you know, the balls and the grips on the balls and how pitchers get their grips on the balls, that ultimately will, you know, be resolved in a way that helps give guys perhaps a little better command and improves player safety as a result.
Two more things for you, Rick, before we let you go on the Baseball Tonight podcast. A couple months before the trade deadline, take us inside the process. Are you already talking to teams about specific players and then you tell them we'll check back with you next month or 6 weeks from now? Like, how specific are you now compared to how specific you'll get a month from now?
I'd say our conversations internally are more specific than they are externally. And by that, I mean, literally yesterday, Kenny Williams and I had a conversation about a specific player that may not be available, but probably would be a real nice fit for us if he were. And our people have been, you know, doing background research on that and getting prepared for that eventuality. That player's team, the conversation with that player's team are perhaps a little more preliminary because, you know, in this instance, for example, the team isn't quite, you know, necessarily committed to selling and needs more time to understandably assess, you know, whether it makes sense for them to perhaps focus more on the longer term versus the 21 season. So you can get real specific this time of year internally. You can have all sorts of plans lined up and contingencies and alternatives, but ultimately it's going to come down to when a team feels compelled to move, either because an offer is so overwhelming they can't say no, or in more instances than not, that they've made the assessment that this isn't going to be the year for them. So it's perhaps time to move current assets for future ones.
Last thing I have for you, I don't want to rehash the Mercedes 3-0 swing heard around the baseball world, but I do want to ask you a bigger picture question. I think everybody would agree there is a place for sportsmanship. I feel like we all need to come to an agreement, and whether it's write down the rule or ignore the unwritten rule. What I'm getting at is what I found interesting about this whole thing is the two times it's happened in sort of made headlines was last year with Fernando Tatis and here with Germain. And in both cases, all four managers and three of them being of the newer, younger generation did not like the player swinging. Both Jace Tingler and Woodard were critical. Now Tingler walked it back, but initially critical. And then obviously Tony and Rocco Baldelli, I think, hasn't had enough attention because the Twins expressed their displeasure and then threw at Mercedes. Like, so where is this? I mean, I think most fans agree with kind of the player swinging, but I agree there should be some sportsmanship in the game. But why did four managers, I guess maybe the adults in the room, take this one side of it and many other people took the other side? Rick, what's your take on that whole thing? We all just come to agreement. Either it's okay to swing or it's okay not to swing.
I don't know if you're ever going to come to an agreement on anything related to the game, especially when you're talking about perhaps older school perspectives and newer school perspectives. I think the one thing that perhaps, hopefully, we can all agree about on is that there should be room in the game for everyone's perspective to be heard, that there should be respect for the older school or older view of, you know, how the game is supposed to be played, just as there should be respect for how the game has evolved and how the game has changed and how players expressing themselves in the modern game may not necessarily be a sign of disrespect to the other mm-hmm. team as opposed to their own self-expression and celebration. And while any individual's views, especially, you know, if you say, quote, sort of the newer age view may favor the player celebration, I think at the very least we can all understand that we should respect everyone's opinion, whether they agree with that perspective or they don't. And they're more from the older school that you expressed from each of the managers in that situation. In the end, I think everyone's trying to protect their team ultimately.
Right. Right.
And no one wants to, you know, be insulted. It's just sort of a matter of, you know, what precisely is perhaps viewed as disrespectful and what isn't. In the end, quite frankly, Jesse, my concern is about the Chicago White Sox winning ball games, as opposed to coming up with some sort of broad perspective on written versus unwritten rules. Let's just win ball games here.
Sure thing. That was a lot of noise, but in terms of leading into the sort of younger generation and the way of doing things, I know the White Sox are doing that this weekend. I think it's the first ever bat flip bobblehead. Tim Anderson is going to have a bat flip bobblehead you're giving away this weekend. So I imagine he's going to put one on Tony's desk. I imagine that's going to happen at some point, right?
As long as it's hopefully he gets another opportunity to do that and celebrate a walk-off here at some point in the not too distant future.
Absolutely. Rick, thanks for doing this. You have a fun team to watch. Good luck the rest of the season.
Hey, I appreciate it, Jesse. Thanks for having me.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Jesse. Bleacher Tweets for a Wednesday. First up, we put the call out last night for tweets for you, and I think this is an appropriate one to lead off with. Our guy Kyle Benning at Kyle_Benning, big Chicago Cubs fan. He writes in, roughly a third of the way of the season in, both the Cubs and White Sox are in contention for the Central Crowns. What aspect does each team need to address at the trade deadline to ensure they're playing baseball in October?
Well, for the White Sox, it's a rarity for a contending team. They really don't need a lot of pitching. Now, you can never have enough. We've heard that before, but they're pretty good right now. If the trade deadline was this week, you'd say that's a pretty good pitching staff. Maybe they should address some other areas. I think they need a left-handed bat. They're kind of a 500-ish team against right-handed pitching. They were under 500 against righties last year. Now, they beat Jack Flaherty last night. That's probably one of their best wins against a righty over the last couple of seasons. So I think they probably need to address the left side of the batter's box, maybe grab an additional outfielder since they've had injuries out there. But it's amazing to think that this team could be pretty good on the mound, barring any new health issues popping up among their pitching staff. Now, in terms of the Cubs, if they want to compete, they have to pick up a rotation guy or two. and a stud if that's possible. I mean, ironically, they could use Yu Darvish. Are the Padres trading Yu Darvish back to them in July? That's what they need. And they probably need more than one arm to compete heading into October or even just getting to October. So those are a couple of needs on both sides of town.
Doesn't seem like the Cubs are going to be playing in October.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go to Max Leibowitz at @M_Leibowitz. He writes in, I'll be at Wrigley in September. Any experience / food recommendations that are a must have? People are getting back to the ballparks. Where should Max go when he goes to Wrigleyville?
Well, exactly. It's Wrigleyville. Inside is nice enough, obviously, but it's really outside if you've never been to the area. I mean, there's not many ballparks right in the middle of a neighborhood, all sorts of bars and restaurants. They redid the outside a few years ago called Gallagher Way, where there's some grass out there. You can play with the kids and there's a big screen where you can watch highlights and the pregame. You can even watch the game if you leave early and just want to stretch your legs. And of course, as I mentioned, tons of bars and restaurants. I don't think I could pick one out. Just start going down all of them, get to the game early, hit them all, and then go inside and have the Wrigley field experience as well, Max. You'll enjoy it.
I'm a big fan of Moe's Cantina and Deuces over there.
I bet you are, Taylor. I could see you being a Moe's guy for sure.
Oh, love the rooftop at Moe's. So this brings me to my personal question. As the mayor of Chicago and attending, I'm assuming, games at Wrigley for ages, have you ever had a wild afternoon at Wrigley Field that you would care to share with the listeners?
Well, I'd say yes. And it was probably when I was much younger, to be honest. Okay, so I go back to the days of Harry Caray broadcasting from the bleachers. And you have to understand, man, these days when broadcasters are in the bleachers, there's all sorts of security and, you know, roped off where the tables are and stuff. Like, you can't go here, you can't go there. Back then, Harry Caray would be bleachers. There would be a table, but you could sit right next to him. So I would get up at 6:30 in the morning. I would take, and then I was about 15 or 16. I would take a bus to a train to get to Wrigley Field because my folks aren't driving me at that point. I would get in line for the bleachers at 7 a.m. because there's general admission. And I'd be sitting next to Harry Caray. My mom would see me on TV.
Oh, nice.
And it was wild. I mean, I'm 16. A lot of people are much older than me, having beer, going crazy. Harry's pulling out beers from his own cooler. And again, you could sit right next to him. So that's from my youth. I mean, I had plenty of crazy days in my 20s, but we've all had those. Not everybody can say they sat next to Harry Caray in the bleachers. So that's something I'll remember forever.
Absolutely. That is very cool. Are you pro or anti beer snake?
Oh, I'm pro. I'm pro. Okay. Anything. Yeah. Anything to have some fun out there. I'm pro.
Okay.
You know, not so much the wave.
Oh, the wave stinks.
Yeah. Yeah. Not so much the wave. In Chicago, that's really a guaranteed rate White Sox thing. I saw the wave last night at the White Sox game. Cub fans would frown on the wave. It just, you know, depends on who you are. So growing up at Wrigley Field, because I was a Cub fan growing up, I never did see the wave. When I started going to the White Sox games, I saw the wave. But other than that, I'm all for the fun out there in between pitches.
All right. Good stuff. Last one for today. T. Jones at TNJ629 writes in, what's the most dramatic Major League Baseball moment you've ever witnessed in person?
Well, that's easy for me. Growing up a Cub fan and then covering the team, watching them break the 108-year drought, World Series drought, in Cleveland in 2016. Now, within that Game 7, you might say it's the final out, which is dramatic in itself, but it was just a ground ball to third base. To be honest, Rajah Davis's home run in the eighth inning of Aroldis Chapman probably was the most dramatic MLB moment I witnessed in person. I mean, I was in the press box. I hit the two people next to me on either side of me. I just like threw my arms out and hit them on the shoulder because it was just such a shocking moment. And knowing Cub fans as well as I do, most believe that was it, game over, even though it was just, you know, a game tying home run. Most thought, okay, it's the Cubs. This is going to happen again. They're going to go down to defeat in a very dramatic way. Instead, they went to victory in a very dramatic way. But that moment probably was the most dramatic that I've seen in person.
Interesting wrinkle. That's what I thought you would say, game seven, but that's interesting that you felt that way in that moment. All right, good stuff today. Thanks for writing in, everyone. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. And don't forget to follow, rate, and review this podcast wherever you listen to your podcast. Buster is back tomorrow.
That's all for today. My thanks to Mark, Rick, Joe, and Taylor. And thanks to Buster Olney, who let me sit in his seat for a day. He'll be back tomorrow. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, check out the Fantasy Focus podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. The Baseball Tonight podcast.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.